funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
The U.S. is not the world's most populous country, and we do not have the world's highest overall crime rate. But we have more people in prison than any other country, more, in fact, than all of China and India combined. This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. One could say we have created a nation within a nation behind the walls of our 5,000 state, federal, and local correctional facilities. The nearly 2.3 million Americans locked up at any given time find themselves in places that have a culture, history, language, and value system distinct from that of the general population. And adapting successfully to modes of behavior in prison makes it very hard to reintegrate into society once a sentence is complete. My guest believes we have the power to remake American correctional institutions into centers for education and rehabilitation rather than punishment alone, and argues all Americans would benefit if we could summon the will to do it. Mary D. Luman is a psychologist at the Oklahoma Department of Corrections Reception Center and adjunct professor of criminal justice at the University of Oklahoma. Her new book, written with co-author John D. Carl, is called A Country Called Prison, Mass Incarceration and the Making of a New Nation. Mary, welcome to Think.
Well, thank you for having me on.
How did it occur to you that people in the criminal justice system are effectively contained in a separate nation within the borders of the United States?
I think I have a unique perspective in that I have worked in the criminal justice mental health area for nearly 25 or 30 years, beginning all the way with juvenile detention through incarceration and also community recovery programs. So I've seen a wide breadth of people, and I began to notice that they seem to be different from people who don't go to prison. Their childhoods are different. The way they think and process information is different. And so I wanted to start researching more about that to see if my idea was correct. And that's why John, who's a sociologist, and myself, a psychologist, wrote from that perspective of social science rather than criminal justice.
And lots of people listening might say, well, they're different because they have broken the law. But you note that depending on race and social class, a crime like, for example, drug possession may be shrugged off for one group of Americans as a rite of passage or an experimental phase. For a low-income American, particularly a person of color, this is their ticket to a jail cell.
Absolutely. Almost 15 years of research has shown that the poor African-American, Hispanic people tend to go to prison more often than the others, even for drugs. And here's an example. Crack cocaine, which is usually much cheaper than powder cocaine, the sentence for having possession of crack cocaine is 15 years, where powder cocaine, it might be a 3 to 5 year sentence.
And you say this is possession, this is use, this isn't distributing these drugs in any way. This is simply having them to use them.
Yes, it's having them in your pocket, maybe a small baggie of it.
You write that the United States incarcerates those who frighten society as well as those at whom society is mad. What percentage of people who are behind bars are violent?
Only about 15% across the board, some areas maybe 20, but it's not really that many. And a violent crime is murder, rape, kidnapping, armed robbery. These are very frightening. Also sexual offenses and child molestation. These are definitely people I want in prison, and I want them staying in prison. But 70 to 75% are people who have possession of a drug, marijuana, meth, sometimes cocaine, sometimes Xanax that's not a prescription. These people are not really scary to me. I mean, I maybe don't want them in a park next to my grandchildren, but do they need to be in prison at $20,000 a year and in some states $30,000 a year?
How are predictions about future behavior used to make decisions about who's released on parole?
That's an interesting one. It really has to do with the time. Let's say you're given a 5-year sentence. With good behavior and earned credit, which means you get a GED, you might be out of prison in about 14 months. So that's all that it takes to get out, just the time clicking by. You don't have to be rehabilitated. You don't have to have a GED. You don't have to have vocational training. It's when your time clock is up, out you go.
How does the absence of young men of color affect the communities they leave behind when they are sent to prison or jail?
This is the one area in our book that we really stressed, and there's other books that are coming out in the last couple of years. We just count money-wise the state budgets, which is somewhere in about $52 billion, as in 2013. But we don't count the loss to tax-paying money. Most people coming to prison work and pay taxes. They circulate money in the neighborhood by renting, buying a car, taking their children out for dinner. That all goes away when they go to prison. They become tax users. But also what usually happens, too, is the children involved in that family end up in child welfare. Sometimes they end up in foster care. That all costs money also. Usually the spouse has to now go to work, has to find daycare. Often that can't be done. Therefore, the ability of the family to sustain itself while a parent or primary breadwinner goes to prison. So it's not just the person going to prison. It's the entire family that ends up in prison.
So by a wide margin, the United States has the world's largest population of people in prison or jail. How did we get to a place where we incarcerate so many people?
It's a matter of perspective. In the European countries in particular, they see drug addiction and mental illness as a public health problem. So they treat it. They have lots of treatment centers. They have lots of programs. They have lots of ways that people can get help. Whereas in America, we see drug addiction as a crime, as something that has to be punished away. And there is no research in the world that will tell you that an addict can be punished away. It's a treatment issue. It's a mental health problem.
What kind of access do people who have a documented mental illness have to mental health services when they're behind bars?
Not really. Even though I'm a psychologist there, my job is really just to ascertain how serious their symptoms are and to refer them for medication. We have some programs for drug addiction, but when you consider the number of people in prison, there's only about 3% of the population gets help. Definitely if you have a mental health problem such as bipolar or schizophrenia, which are very serious mental illnesses and require treatment, require counseling, helping to learn how to manage your symptoms, also appropriate medication, and long-term planning for when you are released, that just doesn't exist. It's too expensive.
I'm thinking about people in the general population who have these severe mental illnesses, who have not committed a crime, are not locked up, and you know, unusual stresses can exacerbate their symptoms. I wonder what you've learned about living in a prison or a jail and how that affects people who are fragile from a mental health perspective to begin with.
That's a very good point. And obviously, coming to prison is extremely stressful, even if you're healthy. When you already have a compromise, then coming is even more difficult. As an example, when I'm interviewing a new person coming in, they may have been on mental health medication in the community, and they'll say, no, I don't want any medication because I just don't want to have to go to the pill line, and everybody will see that I'm crazy. Because it's, you can't just, you know, you're there with everybody watching you, so they know who is on mental health and who isn't. What happens then is they go off their medication, and then eventually the suicide rate is higher, the therapeutic seclusion rate is higher. These are things that are very difficult for people to manage. Imagine living in a room 6x8 with a toilet and a sink in it and two people living in that cell, and you live there every day. The stress goes up.
Tell us a little bit about the philosophies that have played into the American view that prisons in general, not simply for drug crimes, but in general, should really be about punishment. That if you go to prison, you are going there because you are being punished for doing something bad.
First of all, I agree that most people who come to prison have broken the law. I just think that they don't. We're spending a lot of money on something that's maybe could be handled in community corrections or through a treatment center. But what happens is in America, we believe that if you've broken society's standards, then you need a harsh punishment. Because if it's really bad, if prison is a horrible, horrible situation, then you'll never want to go back. And yet I interview people every day that have been in prison 2 and 3 and 4 times. And to them, it's not much different than at home. When you are poor and you don't have a lot of food, you don't have a lot of extra money to buy nice things, that's pretty much prison. I mean, in prison, you get 3 meals a day. You get a place to sleep. You make friends. You do a little bit of work. I mean, it's in relatively, it's not that horrible as people think. You are away from your family, which is very, very difficult. But what happens is when you, let's take an example, a little child. They maybe crayon on the wall, and they're 4 years old, and so they're in trouble. And so mom says, you have to stand in the corner for 30 seconds because you did something wrong. So the child stands in the corner and goes, ooh, I don't like this, and I'm not going to do that again. Well, what happens when you take somebody that has, you know, a baggie full of marijuana, and they haven't, you know, stolen anything, they haven't hurt their neighbors or anything like that, and you put them in prison for 3 years? That's a little too much. It's too much punishment. So what happens then is they don't learn. They just learn how to be angrier. They learn how to be a better criminal. Prison is a great training ground for learning how to do even more sophisticated crimes.
What do most inmates do when they are in, say, a state prison? How often are there opportunities to use time served productively?
That's a very hard question. I'm not sure productive is the right word. In a normal day, you would get up, you would go to the chow hall for breakfast, you would go back to your room. Most people in prison sit around all day long, and some of them have TV privileges, some of them don't. Some of them do have jobs, like most of prisons, the offenders actually do a lot of the work. They do the cleaning, the cooking, mowing the grass, painting. That kind of thing. But they don't do very skilled work. Like there's only a few offenders that are electricians or plumbers or carpentry kind of people. So, you know, most of the time in prison is very boring.
Of course, there are people who are incensed by the idea that, you know, a GED may be one thing, but they are really bothered by the fact that you could be behind bars for having committed a crime and, say, get an associate's degree or even a correspondence bachelor's degree.
In all my years of working in prison, it's less than 0.5% are able to do that. It's really not. To some extent, people coming in for nonviolent crimes, I would rather spend $20,000 of my taxpayer money and send them to a university. We'd get somebody educated out of that. 1 year in the university is about $20,000. There are many in prison that would benefit very well. Statistically, we know for the last 20 years in research, people with degrees don't usually reoffend.
How profitable is the prison industry in America?
Well, it's obviously profitable because they're still around after 12 or 15 years. That's one area that, when it started, really, really bothered me as a moral person, as a person. I mean, I like our country because we can start new businesses and it's kind of fun, and that's what makes us a great country. But when we make a profit off of putting people in prison, especially when they're mostly poor people and people of color, that bothers me quite a bit. But yes, they're very profitable.
And the taxpayer, I guess what we're paying as taxpayers is more if we're hiring out private companies to run these prisons, or is it approximately the same?
It kind of depends. In a way, it's the same, but the treatment of the persons at the private prisons is not as, you know, they're not getting rehabilitated even more. Most of the private prisons, you're in lockdown most of the time, whereas in the state prisons, you're at least out and about and trying to do something productive and stuff. But it's not so much that it costs more. It's just that we're building more of them. It's sort of like the build it and they will come. And we can't just keep putting people away. It's unsustainable. It's going to be too much money.
Mary D. Luman is my guest. She is a psychologist at the Oklahoma Department of Corrections Reception Center and an adjunct professor of criminal justice at the University of Oklahoma. Her new book, written with John D. Carl, is called A Country Called Prison, Mass Incarceration and the Making of a New Nation. Join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372. Email think@kera.org or find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Fall registration is now open with courses in art, architecture, history, literature, and more. Registration online at smu.edu/CAPE.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Mary D. Luman, a psychologist at the Oklahoma Department of Corrections Reception Center and professor of criminal justice at the University of Oklahoma. Her new book is called A Country Called Prison, Mass Incarceration and the Making of a New Nation. Join us at 800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. Mary, there may be people listening who say, well, this is too bad for criminals, but they have done something wrong and they deserve to be punished. The deal is, though, that by putting people in these situations and giving them this sort of learned helplessness, as you describe it in the book, we're not actually preventing recidivism the way we would like to. We're not guaranteeing that after they're done with prison, they won't do something else.
Absolutely correct. This is a misnomer that most citizens have. They feel like if people got convicted of a crime, they should do prison. One thing, they believe that people are getting a jury of their peers. Most people plea bargain and just sign whatever they can get to get in and get out quicker. So they're not necessarily guilty or not guilty. They're just signing up for, like, let me do my time and get out. But the dilemma that we have is somebody might go to prison for, say, 2 years because they have done marijuana or maybe a simple theft. When they get out, they will no longer be able to vote. They will not walk out of prison with a driver's license or a Social Security card, so they cannot go get a job until they get that. They don't often know how to get that. There's usually fees involved in getting a driver's license again. They walk out with no money, no car. Their families don't usually have the money to get them all new clothes and get them to jobs and do that. So what's happening is somebody may do a crime and learn and say, I don't ever want to go back. But then in the next month, they can't get started again. And this is probably the greatest dilemma and the thing that most citizens don't understand. So altogether in our book, we talk about that, that when you talk about the 16 million in prison right now, there's also another 50 million out there that can't ever rejoin society. They don't start paying taxes again. They don't start paying rent and buying cars and circulating money in the arena. So what happens then is, what do we do with those citizens that are just basically living off of the rest of the taxpayers?
What do we do with prison culture and prison programs in order to change some of that, to make, mm-hmm. if nothing else, to give people a fair shot at reestablishing themselves in something that is legally permissible and will allow them to support themselves once they're out?
Mm-hmm. Well, this is one area that John and I really address in the book importantly, is it really takes some simple changes in prison that wouldn't cost money. Right now, people just seem to be thrown into prison. They look more at the crime and what bed is open. If they would separate out the different offenders by age group, for instance, the 18 to 25-year-olds, if they were all in one prison, then we could focus on getting them their GED, getting them maybe an AA degree, helping them learn about plumbing and electrical and whatever else kind of certified skill that they could get. The 30 to 40-year-olds, they already have families. They already maybe have somewhat of a career or skill set. We could help them get jobs when they leave. We could work with that group. So if we separated out people by their age groups, which is normal in society, we would never think of putting kindergartners in the same school as high schoolers. We would never think of putting people, mixing them all up, elderly people with younger people in like our churches. We always separate people out by age groups. So if prisons would just do that, one, it would get rid of a lot of the violence. When you have older offenders who've been in prison several times around the younger ones, it just doesn't work very well. So we would then be able to focus on getting the right classes in a relatively inexpensive way. Another thing that we can do is they don't use the internet the way they could. They say, well, the offenders will get on there and do bad things. Not if it's controlled. For instance, I teach online courses at OU, and I have students in Japan. I have students in Europe. I have students, right down the hall from me. What happens is prisons are way behind in learning how to use the technology effectively and efficiently to get people trained and get them certified. Why can't we have job fairs at prisons where job people looking for workers could come to the prison and do a job fair? Why can't we have online interviews? We could have people ready to go out the door when they go. We should be able to get them their driver's license, their social security card. We have the internet. We have printers. We should be able to do all of that.
Are people who leave a prison term and actually find employment within a couple of months less likely to reoffend?
Yes, we know that for sure. And that's 10 or 15 years of research has shown that. The people who are working tend to not come back. But we're talking about work that pays the bills. Leaving prison and working at fast food is not going to help them if they have a family. So we're talking about, work that can be like a lot of the people that I have met working in prison is they have the capability of becoming plumbers, electricians, welders, truck drivers. They're pretty smart people. They just need to have a chance to learn how to do it.
Let's go to the phones now at 1-800-933-5372. Rob is on the line in Dallas. Hi, Rob.
Hello. I agree very much with what you're saying. I have two friends back in Ohio. Both, they were brothers. They both went to jail. They were guilty and all that. But one of the brothers was a skilled mechanic, and the other brother was like a cosmetologist. And since they've got now, neither one could get a license from the state of Ohio to do their prospective work. And so they formed a lawn care business, which is still sort of not legal because they couldn't even get a license for that. And I just think, what's the point of, I was taught as a kid, you go to jail, you get out, and you're supposed to be rehabilitated, but they still can't get legitimate legal work.
You want to address that, Mary?
Oh, yes. Thank you. And Sarah, thank you so much for that, because I see that all the time. I think there are some states right now working on thinking about getting people being able to get their licenses back, like especially plumbers and electricians and people like that. This is the hardest thing for me to watch happen is we don't forgive. Here we are supposedly a Christian country. And yet we don't understand the concept of forgiveness. And I really think that that's a very, very critical thing that we have to do within the next year or two, is the states need to pass laws where people can have a chance to recertify. Now, maybe they have to be under some kind of mentorship, or maybe they have to do some kind of counseling. I don't know that you should just give it to them without some proof that they are going to behave. The other thing is, when we talk about it in the book, is the concept of automatic expungement. You can expunge a felony record, but it takes a lot of money and a lawyer. And we think after about 3 years, if you've not reoffended and you're working and you're doing some pro-social activity in our country and you're being productive, then it should just be wiped out and you should never have to say, I've been in prison.
Yeah, that's there are people who may want to have jobs. They may in their hearts sort of feel like they are ready to do the right thing. But a lot of employers, understandably so, there's a stigma in this country to hiring someone with a rap sheet.
Yes, and that's true. And I agree. I mean, I have helped four people come out of prison. I've worked with them each 1 year. And one of the people, didn't make it, kind of hurt. My feelings were hurt. Here I was trying to help and all that. And they couldn't hold it together. And they went back to a criminal life. But it's not that high of a percentage. I think businesses, if they offered some kind of mentorship program where they would help people learn and have a coach, kind of a job coach that would at least their first year, I think a lot of people remember that most people going to prison are dropped out of school by the time they were in eighth grade. So they have not learned those skills, the social skills, the job skills of just being employable, but they're willing to learn. Most people that I meet in prison want to have a normal life. They want to work. They want to raise a family. They want to do all those things that they see everybody else doing, but they don't have a clue how to get there.
Some of the suggestions that you and your co-author have in the book about changing the culture within prisons almost sound like you are writing for like a progressive boarding school somewhere. Much more supportive opportunities for supportive relationships between inmates and staff, and the opportunity for people to sort of build their communication skills. Talk a little bit about what's important and how this could be achieved without compromising the safety of inmates or certainly of staff members.
That's a good point. And it is tricky in prison because there are some dangerous people in prison. And we do have to be careful about that. But I think we get carried away sometimes with the blue line between us. But it's fun that you said it's like a boarding school. I hadn't really thought about it like that. But in a way, it is. How do you learn how to be a citizen if nobody models that behavior? How do you learn good problem-solving techniques if you don't have somebody to talk to about that? How do you learn kindness if nobody shows you kindness? So it's a lot like when you're raising children. They tend to become the way you raise them to be. A lot of people in prison come from broken homes, come from chaos, abuse, neglect, poverty. I have met people that have told me when they were five, they knew what restaurants had the best food in their dumpster. That's very sad for me.
Yeah.
So that's one reason we talk about that is without the modeling behavior, without the dialogue all day long with somebody that's willing to share a different life, how can they learn a different life? We certainly do that with immigrants who come over from other countries. Somebody will sponsor that family. They will help them get naturalized. They will help them learn about America, the Constitution. You drive on the right side of the road, not the left side of the road. So we do that with other people. Why can't we do that with our own citizens?
800-933-5372 is our number. We have Bruce on the line in Mansfield. Hello, Bruce.
Hi. Thanks for having me on.
Sure.
Thanks for your conversation. I just had a question, more of a comment maybe. Any thoughts to why it seems that there are so few prison sentences for white-collar crime, which I think are sometimes as bad as some violent crimes? Because I think they cripple the social institutions that society depends on and kind of perpetuates the idea that jail is only to keep the poor from revolting against the injustice system, kind of like during the Jim Crow era?
Yes, I actually agree with you, and I've seen that in my lifetime. Again, most white-collar crimes are by educated people. They're by people who have money, so you can have a better lawyer. So, you know, that's one reason why. The other thing is most white-collar crimes are federal, and it's just a different kind of process. The federal systems actually have a better rehabilitation program going and are a lot better off in that sense. I don't know if that answers your question or not, but
are there things that other countries have done to look at restitution rather than incarceration? For example, if my car gets stolen and the person who stole it is not going to hurt anyone, I really just want my car back. I don't necessarily need to know that. You know what I mean? Like, maybe I want
yes.
that individual to pay a fine and to return my car, but I don't necessarily need to know that somebody's behind bars for 5 years.
No. Actually, I'm excited because in the last few years, there's been a big movement on something called restorative justice. And this has been going on in Europe for quite some time, but we're starting to do it in the United States. And this is exactly what you're talking about. It's where the victims and the person doing it kind of get together. And if the victim doesn't want to be involved, the person still has a kind of compensates directly the community. This, of course, is the concept of community sentencing. It's the concept of drug court and mental health court. We are trying to start pushing it back into the community. This is one thing that we've seen a lot of research on is people who have to actually account for their behavior to their neighborhood, to their victim, actually rarely reoffend because of that whole process of having to say you're sorry.
And there's also, I suppose, a human victim that is understood to have been affected by this crime.
Absolutely. That's one thing I see when people come to prison. They really are disconnected with the harm that they did. When I say to the person, what is your crime? They'll say, oh, it's a burglary, too. And they just whip it out. And when I ask them, though, what exactly did you did? I get a totally different response. I get the head down, a shame face. They mumble. They really don't want to tell you what they did. But it's easy to say, oh, it's a burglary, too. And it disconnects them from the humanness of it. So, yes, restorative justice programs are, I think, much more effective than just locking somebody up.
Let's speak on the phone now with Jerry in Denton. Hi, Jerry. Jerry, are you with us? Okay, we will move on and speak instead with Zach in Hearst. Hi, Zach.
Hi. It seems to me like a central problem that we have is that we get so wrapped up in this idea of punishment. I'm a pretty committed utilitarian, and I think our goal should be to minimize the future harm done by crime to society. And so when we start thinking from that perspective, we start asking questions like, what can we do to minimize the risk that this person is going to reoffend? Or in cases such as a murder, can we ever allow this person to be around other people where they have the opportunity to do it again? And from this perspective, it makes you wonder why we get so wrapped up in this idea of punishment as though there's some sort of moral evening that's taking place.
Very good point, and that's exactly it. You can't – corrections, prisons, they don't stop crime. Everybody thinks that it's a deterrent. It's not a deterrent. We have to do something ahead of the crime to stop the crime. So obviously more work in, you know, with children in school, more help with getting people better jobs, more help with making sure we don't have dropouts. The two factors where you see mostly in prison is dropping out of school by eighth or ninth grade and poverty. Those are the two common things throughout the entire prison system. So what can we do to stop that? What can we do to help people get working and involved in the community?
Do you think the impediment to making these changes is the fact that people might be willing to think about making changes before individuals have offended? But once they have, a lot of people have very little tolerance for the idea that there's extra help involved for someone who has been convicted of multiple crimes.
I think that's because people think, generally speaking, that people are bad, therefore they commit crimes. That is not what I have seen. Most of the people I've met in prison are good people. They're kind, they're thoughtful to each other, they're polite, they're cooperative, they care about their parents, they care about their spouse, their children, but they just don't know how to live productively in our society because they did drop out. But the thing is that once you begin to say that person is bad, therefore the only thing good for them is punishment, then you forget to see their good qualities. That's all you see is that they're bad. They deliberately did it. They deliberately broke the law. I've just not seen that in my 30 years of working in corrections.
Mary D. Luman is my guest. She's a psychologist at the Oklahoma Department of Corrections Reception Center and adjunct professor of criminal justice at the University of Oklahoma. Her new book, written with co-author John D. Carl, is called A Country Called Prison, Mass Incarceration and the Making of a New Nation. You can be part of the conversation by calling 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, offering the SMU Certificate Program, where you can take courses in art, architecture, history, literature, and more. Registration online at smu.edu/CAPE.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with a psychologist at the Oklahoma Department of Corrections Reception Center, Mary D. Luman. Her new book, written with co-author John D. Carl, is called A Country Called Prison, Mass Incarceration and the Making of a New Nation. Join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. Mary, can you describe for us, if I've been in prison for 10 years and I know that my scheduled release is coming a year from now, what kind of resources, what kind of preparation do I receive leading up to that year so that I will know what to do once I get back out?
Actually, not very much. You don't get to be on the internet. You don't get to have a cell phone. You don't get to talk to employers before you go. Basically, they don't even start until about a month out. They make sure your family or hopefully somebody will come and get you. Sometimes they just have a bus ticket for you and you can, you know, get to your family that way. They sometimes they're starting to do where they have a driver's license and a Social Security card for them, or at least a birth certificate. They're working on getting that in place better. But basically, there isn't a lot. Sometimes the families try to find jobs for them, construction or something to just get them started. But again, a lot of places won't hire you once you're a felon. Even fast food places sometimes will not hire you. So there really isn't a lot of preparation. In the few people that I've helped come out, there's just not out there. You pretty much walk out the gate with a bag of a few clothes, and sometimes you have a small check. If you've been working in the prison, you might have $150 or something like that. But you don't have a driver's license, so you can't cash the check.
I realize that each individual case has to be taken individually, but generally speaking, is there evidence to suggest that an employer who hires someone, a nonviolent offender who has done his or her time, is likely to be damaged in some way by that employee? Is that employee more likely to steal from the business or do something detrimental?
No, not really. I think there's actually companies that I know that they do hire, and they want to hire, and they really try to do the right thing, and they help them get back on their feet, and they might even give them some money up front to get clothes and things like that. There are a lot of agencies like that. Well, not a lot. I shouldn't say a lot. There's more and more. So it's just statistically not there. One of the things a company can do is require random urinary samples to make sure they're not doing drugs and stuff. But again, most people, the only reason they steal is because they're trying to survive. And I know on this program, it sounds like I'm just, you know, think they're all just wonderful. No, they have broken the law. They have made choices that are wrong. I just think there's a better effective way of helping them become productive citizens. And that's the point of our book, is how can we do that?
You recommend resources and even housing support for up to a year after inmates are released from prison. Mm-hmm. How can we ensure they use that year productively?
Well, obviously, we need a mentoring program. We need, in a way, it's kind of like AA. We need sort of an anonymous for felons where they can meet and get coaching and training. It's interesting because young adults leave college, and their first year on the job, a lot of companies have mentoring programs for students coming out of college. I know I worked at a major corporation, and that was part of my job, was I had a new college student that I mentored for a year to help them learn how the company works and learn how to be successful in that company. So I don't know why we can't do it for that. A lot of the businesses where a lot of felons go is the manual ones where, you know, the plumbers, electricians, carpenters, construction people. Those are all just needing somebody. Most of the time, they just need a ride. Most of the time, they just need some clothes. They need a lunch. They need that. But it's really hard coming out of prison because of the stigma of it, the terrible, terrible things you've witnessed in prison. It takes you a while, just like coming back from a war zone, to get over that. And so you need somebody coaching you and helping you along.
Let's go to the phones now. We have Lena on the line in Dallas. Hi, Lena.
Hi. I am a former district judge in Dallas County. And while I wholly support people hiring convicted felons, I do have to ask your author if she's familiar with Dr. Latessa's findings regarding what actually causes criminal behavior. We are taught in Dallas County and throughout Texas that while, yes, people may steal because they're poor, most poor people don't steal because they understand the consequences, and the bad consequences outweigh the good. And so the key, we are told, is that they really need cognitive behavioral treatment. In other words, we need to correct their thinking errors, and that's the emphasis that we use in our rehabilitation programs in Texas. And I'm wondering if they've implemented that in Oklahoma.
Thanks for your call.
Oh, thank you so much. And yes, ma'am, I actually have read her stuff, and I actually practice that myself when I'm doing work with offenders that I can when they're getting ready to release. And you're exactly right. Certainly, most people in poverty do not commit crimes, and there is we know that from childhood and how they start in early childhood, that their thinking is incorrect. And there's lots of ones, several programs that I'm aware of that do an excellent job in retraining people how to think correctly. And absolutely agree with that. that. I think it's not necessarily Oklahoma, but I think scattered throughout the country, more and more people are beginning to understand that it requires treatment to get over things that keep you making the same decision over and over again. And so I'm very, very glad you brought that up.
What about the opportunities for care for people who are in prison who have committed crimes arguably because they are mentally ill? If we decide that we will continue to incarcerate them, I guess that's what we're going to do, how would the cost of caring for them in an outpatient setting in the community compare with the cost of keeping them in prison for a year?
Obviously, anything on the outside is going to be cheaper. But there is a dilemma with people with serious mental illnesses and criminal behavior. I mean, I get nervous about somebody with especially bipolar or schizophrenia. Their thinking is very erratic at times. They have hallucinations, so they don't always know what's real. And they can be dangerous. And so I don't think putting them in prison is the right thing because they do need treatment. But what happens is we need more day treatment programs. We need places where people can go during the day and receive treatment. A lot of people with serious mental illnesses have difficulty maintaining a job, but they could maybe do a little part-time job. But we really do need to make, I think, more group homes or halfway houses for people like this where they can be cared for in a healthy way, but yet safe from doing things that might hurt other people.
Let's go back to the phones now. We have Frank on the line in Mansfield. Hello, Frank.
Hello.
Hi, go right ahead, please.
I'm right here.
All right, what do you have to say? Yes, we're here.
I'm 59. I got out in 94, and I've been trying to find help. I have no way of getting around. I got a driver's license, but it's been suspended. I got a couple warrants, but they're for tickets, you know. And I'm scrapping. I'm doing whatever I can to get a dog. And I got disabilities. But I'm just living from here to here, you know. I've been dumpster diving for survival. But I need help.
Mary, do you have thoughts for someone like Frank who is trying to get a job and has been unsuccessful?
Yeah. First of all, there really are usually places, churches, a lot of churches have that. The Department of Human Services in most states have lists of people who provide help for people who are trying to get back on their feet, if they're homeless, if they just need a job, if they need medical care. So a phone call to that organization, usually in any phone book, at the beginning of the phone book, there's a section called community services and there's 800 numbers that people can call. So usually they're out, but that is a problem is a lot of people don't always know how to reach those. It's not like they're on the corner everywhere, but that's where I would begin is maybe a public library could help you locate some phone numbers of agencies that could help.
Do prisons offer drug treatment? A lot of people end up detoxing when they are incarcerated, and they end up at least breaking the physical cycle of addiction because they don't theoretically have access to drugs behind bars. Is there anything else to help them have the skills to cope once they are released?
Well, most prisons do provide drug rehabilitation. In Oklahoma, we have a program called Keys to Life. It's almost in all of our prisons. We also have two facilities, maybe three, that completely are devoted to working on that. It's a 6 and 9 month program, and where you learn about thinking correctly, or correcting your thinking skills, problem solving skills, how not to relapse, the danger of doing drugs, getting, you know, because you can get Hep C and other illnesses, also what it does to your body, teaching you better coping skills, how to manage your frustrations or your anger or your sadness in a healthier way. Learning about dieting. So, yeah, I think that's pretty standard in almost all of them. The dilemma that we have in prison is to really be effective in rehabilitating somebody is they have to be able to be honest, and they have to really get into the nitty-gritty of their lives and the bad choices they've made and the people they've hurt, and be able to do the 12 steps where you recognize your things that you've done wrong. In prison, that's a little dangerous. Bearing your soul can really get you hurt. So again, it's not that effective on the inside. It's much more effective on the outside.
All right, let's go on the phone to Mike in Dallas. Hi, Mike.
Hi.
Hi, go right ahead, please.
I have more of an opinion than a question, but what my experience has been since I've hired a number of, people formerly in prison, is that their moral compass is askew. And the cost as an employer goes up significantly because of that.
And I would agree with you, and that's why I was saying that that companies that would like to hire and do this, they have to have a program that helps them learn how to shift their moral compass, some kind of mentoring program where they are required. One of the most successful programs in the world is in New York City, the Father Peter Young Housing Invention and Treatment. It's www.pyhit.org. I can't remember if it's org or com. And he's been very successful at, and what he does is when they come out of prison for the first 6 months, they're in treatment, they're in work groups, they're in rethinking through all this way and learning how to be more morally correct. And so I myself, if I had a business, would not hire somebody straight out of prison that hadn't had some kind of counseling, some kind of cognitive behavioral therapy, but I would certainly assist them in getting that. And I think that's where businesses need to be heading, is how can they help create that moral compass shift, because then I think they could be productive citizens.
Mary, people who've been behind bars for a number of months or even years have not had to make any decisions for themselves for as long as they've been incarcerated. That can make just being outside really overwhelming for people. Is there a way to somehow increase the autonomy that inmates feel while they're in prison and not necessarily, you know, turn the experience into a country club?
Oh, absolutely. And I'm very excited that that we could get there. And I think that's exactly right. In our book, we talk about that there needs to be a reentry unit at least 1 year out where they can go and actually function as if they were kind of like at a college dorm, where they made decisions about their meals and they would help with the meal preparation and they would figure out, you know, how they would fix their room and things like that. There have been some studies in prisons that have allowed the offender to paint their room or to decorate their room in a certain way or to choose how a day room might be arranged, anything where they can make choices that help. I think that's one of the hardest things about coming out, is you're exactly right. They haven't been allowed to even think. And so how did they learn how to correct their moral thinking if they haven't even been able to practice?
Do you think there's a will for changing the prison system in America?
I don't know about the prison system itself. I know there is a lot of talk now about we have to change something. Mm-hmm. We can't keep going in the direction we're going. We can't just keep locking people up. I think people are experimenting with restorative justice programs, the drug court, the mental health court. I think they're looking at halfway houses. I think they're looking at more community sentencing. I think they're really looking at is locking everybody up for drugs when they're not breaking other crimes. Is that really effective? I think there's not a lot of discussion, though, about how to make prisons more habilitative. And I really hope that that's where we head.
Mary D. Luman is a psychologist at the Oklahoma Department of Corrections Reception Center and co-author, along with John D. Carl, of the new book, A Country Called Prison, Mass Incarceration and the Making of a New Nation. Mary, thank you so much for making this time for us.
Well, thank you for having me on.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is associate producer, with help on the phones today from Lauren Aguirre. Our executive producer is Jeff Whittington. You can find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think. If you want to email the show, the address is think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.